Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, people-powered radio broadcasting from our hideaway studio here in East County. The presidential primary race is heating up, and California is shaping up to be a major player this time around. On our last show, we told you about stops locally by Bernie Sanders and Bill Clinton, and this Friday, Donald Trump is in town, along with a major Stop Trump protest outside the convention center. This week, Trump clinched enough delegates to be the presumptive Republican nominee, but you may be surprised to learn about a major snub against Trump by none other than the local Republican Party, and we'll have details on today's show. We'll also tell you about a voting rights lawsuit filed against the state of California and some counties by Bernie Sanders backers seeking to extend a key deadline for voters. And then on Green Scene, we'll tell you about some not-so-green plans that Trump has announced if he's elected, plans that include rolling back our commitments made by the U.S. to combat climate change and reduce fossil fuel emissions. This Memorial Day weekend, as we all honor and thank our veterans, we'll tell you about some special enforcement planned by the California Highway Patrol. Then for some local East County news, here's the buzz. Lemon Grove's City Council is looking at changes to its beekeeping ordinance, and we'll have the details. Plus, out in El Cajon, police have charged a former Uber driver with 5 additional sexual assaults, including one against a child. We'll have those details on Crime Beat. On our Capitol Report, hear about key protections for the LGBT community that Congress came close to enacting, but that were defeated by a single vote. And we'll tell you which San Diego congressman switched his vote at the last moment to kill the bill. Learn about some beautiful new murals coming to Ramona as part of the Heart Mural Project. And then on the second half of our show today, our bookshelf editor, Raynan Menasche, will be interviewing Kirk Kenny. He's a Union Tribune sports writer and the author of a new book, 100 Things San Diego Padres Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. On Destination East County, we'll have news about all the most fun festivals and events coming up across East County this weekend, including a barbecue with firefighters, the catfish opener out at Santee Lakes, and the Santee Street Fair and Craft Beer Festival. Plus, we'll have previews of some coming attractions coming up in the next couple of weeks here in East County. Finally, we'll be re-airing one of our Best of East County segments on Sounds of History today with Helen Oldfield talking with Cal Calvert out at the Motor Transport Museum in Campo about restoration efforts, including those at the museum as well as Camp Lockett, a historic cavalry post and military base here in East County. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. And to all of our listeners and your families, we wish you a happy and safe Memorial Day weekend. The San Diego County Republican Party's list of endorsed candidates has a glaring omission at the top. There is no endorsement for president. Donald Trump, who visits San Diego this week, has won enough delegates to mathematically qualify to win the National Republican Party nomination, and he's been snubbed by the San Diego County GOP. The inflammatory billionaire's race-baiting rhetoric, flip-flopping on key conservative issues and boasting of marital infidelities have led many conservatives to indicate they would leave the top office blank on their ballot or choose another option such as voting Libertarian or even Democratic or writing in a candidate. The San Diego County Democratic Party, meanwhile, opted against choosing upsides and risking alienating supporters of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton or Senator Bernie Sanders. The local Democratic Party's list of endorsed candidates lists both Clinton and Sanders. The New York Times reported this week that California is now up for grabs, with polls showing the two candidates in a virtual dead heat. Though Clinton is close to securing enough delegates for a majority nationwide, Sanders has been campaigning hard with rallies up and down the state, drawing tens of thousands of voters in most locations as the June 7th primary date approaches. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Only 15% of California's nonpartisan voters with mail-in ballots have requested a presidential primary ballot. That means the vast majority won't be able to vote for president in the June 7th election, and many don't even realize it. Now, civil rights lawyers have filed a lawsuit against the state of California and some counties. The suit claims voting laws are confusing, inconsistent, and amount to disenfranchisement. If the plaintiffs win, the biggest beneficiary could be Bernie Sanders, the Democratic contender who draws heavy support from independent voters, who account for nearly a quarter of the electorate in California. In California, the Democratic, American Independent, and Libertarian parties do allow nonpartisan voters to vote in their primaries, but the voters must specifically request a ballot for one of those parties. Otherwise, they receive a ballot listing no presidential candidates. The Republican Party and some others require voters to be registered in their party to vote. The suit focuses on voters who decline to state party affiliations known as nonpartisan voters. Those with mail-in ballots have to ask for a party ballot to vote for president by Monday, May 31st. But at least one county, Los Angeles, sent voters materials incorrectly listing March 16th, 2.5 months earlier, as the deadline. Plaintiffs in the lawsuit include an organization backing Sanders, as well as two independent voters and the American Independent Party, a conservative political party. An independent expenditure group backing Sanders has launched a Let My People Vote campaign that includes a video discussing voter suppression problems and why the suit was filed. The Republican field has narrowed to just one candidate, Donald Trump. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton leads Sanders, but California's huge delegate count could be pivotal in the race. Sanders is campaigning hard statewide, drawing massive crowds and energizing many young first-time voters. He also could potentially attract some nonpartisan voters disenchanted with Trump, but only if they know they must request a party ballot. The suit contends that information to voters on the rules has been inconsistent from county to county, and in some cases, inaccurate. Some counties failed to tell voters that they had an option to vote for partisan candidates in the primary, while others didn't inform voters with mail-in ballots that they can opt to vote in person at the polls on Election Day and request a party ballot, provided they didn't already mail in their ballot. Even instructions to poll workers vary, with some telling voters about their options to request party ballots while others don't. The state of California has refused to require uniform election information because it doesn't want to pay for materials, Sacramento Bee reported. Sanders lost New York to Clinton largely because of rules that prohibited voters from changing parties for months before the primary, meaning many independent voters who learned about Sanders' candidacy after they could not vote for him. So despite a late surge in polls by Sanders, Clinton won. Sanders lost New York to Clinton largely because of rules that prohibited voters from changing parties for months before the primary, meaning many independent voters who learned about Sanders' candidacy after they could not vote for him. Specifically, the suit asks the Superior Court to extend the deadline until June 7th for nonpartisan voters to request a party ballot for the Democratic, Libertarian, or American Independent Party, or to re-register. It also asks the court to allow write-ins for presidential candidates in those parties, or allow voters who already cast votes on mail-in ballots without presidential candidates listed on the option to re-vote. In addition, the suit asks the court to mandate widespread distribution of this information in media and social media and to assure that election officials have ballots for all presidential primaries at every polling place on Election Day to assure that nonpartisan voters are not denied their rights to receive party ballots at polling places. The suit maintains that provisional ballots should only be offered if there's no other alternative. So, if you're a nonpartisan, independent voter, and you want to vote for president, what should you do? The best choice is to vote in person at your county registrar of voters office and request a ballot for the party of your choice among those parties that allow nonpartisan participation. If you have a mail-in ballot, you can bring it to your polling place on Election Day and ask for a party ballot in the Democratic Party if you want to vote for Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, or the Libertarian or American Independent Party if you wish to vote in their parties. Be aware, however, that the American Independent Party is actually a conservative political party. Thousands of voters who thought they were registering as independent, nonpartisan voters mistakenly registered in the American Independent Party, have recently been flooding registrar offices with requests to change their affiliations. You can also ask to exchange your mail-in nonpartisan ballot for a crossover ballot with any of those parties to vote for a presidential candidate. The deadline to ask to exchange your ballot is May 31st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Ed Barreno with a report from Earth Talk and the editors of E! The Environmental Magazine. In a May 2016 interview with Reuters, presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump dropped a bombshell on environmentalists by stating that he would try to renegotiate the landmark Paris Climate Accord agreed to by 177 nations, including the U.S. in December of 2015, if elected. Calling the agreement one-sided and bad for the United States, Trump said he's, quote, not a big fan because other countries don't adhere to it and China's spewing into the atmosphere, unquote. He added that if he takes the Oval Office, he would, at a minimum, renegotiate the emissions cuts agreed to by the U.S., and said that at the maximum, he may do more. Environmentalists immediately jumped on Trump, long a climate naysayer. Gene Karpinski, president of the nonprofit League of Conservation Voters, said, quote, this is another example of Trump's dangerous lack of judgment and the very real impact it could have for all of us. Billionaire environmental financier and next-gen climate founder Tom Steyer concurred. He called Trump's denunciation of the Paris Accord short-sighted. Steyer worries that a Trump presidency would be terribly costly for the U.S. and would jeopardize the nation's ability to lead the world out of its climate crisis. He adds, quote, we cannot go backwards on this important step towards a clean energy economy that benefits all our families, unquote. Regarding the Paris Accords, he adds, quote, we cannot go backwards on this important step towards a clean energy economy that benefits all our families. But try as he might, a President Trump would have a tough time backing out of U.S. commitments under the Paris Accord. For starters, a clause in the accord forces any signatory nations to wait at least 4 years before withdrawing, meaning Trump couldn't even disentangle the U.S. until his second term, if he even makes it that far. And according to U.S. Chief Climate Envoy Jonathan Pershing, regardless of the outcome of our presidential election come in November, the other signatory countries would remain bound to the terms of the agreement whether Trump likes it or not, so renegotiating isn't really an option. But Trump could undermine American emissions reduction goals set forth in the agreement by overturning the Obama administration's domestic clean power plan, which aims to reduce greenhouse gases from U.S. electrical power generation by a third compared to 2005 levels within 15 years. The Clean Power Act is an essential component in the U.S. plan to dramatically scale back emissions. Joe Rahm of Think Progress adds that Trump could block the ratcheting down of climate targets in the future that are called for under the terms of the Paris Agreement to ensure that participating nations don't backslide after meeting initial commitments. Rahm says Trump's, quote, threat to blow up the only process we have to avoid multiple irreversible catastrophic climate impacts must be taken as seriously as his candidacy. The authors of Earth Talk say that environmentalists' best hope for keeping America's commitments under the Paris Climate Accord alive is to elect a Democrat to the White House in November. Senator Bernie Sanders has taken the opposite view of Trump, saying the Paris Climate Accord does not go far enough to protect our planet. For her part, Hillary Clinton has said she would abide by U.S. commitments made under the Paris Climate Agreement and rally to surpass them as soon as possible, vowing to cut emissions by up to 30% by 2025 and upwards of 80% by mid-century. On the website Quora, Clinton recently stated, quote, the United States must lead the global fight against climate change. We can't wait. There is no planet B.
2 weeks before the hotly contested California Democratic primary elections on June 7th, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has backed out of her earlier pledge to debate her opponent, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, in California. Senator Sanders issued a statement voicing disappointment by Clinton's refusal to debate in the state with the largest number of delegates in the nation. It reads, the state of California and the United States face some enormous crises. Democracy and respect for the voters of California would suggest that there should be a vigorous debate in which the voters may determine whose ideas they support. I hope Secretary Clinton reconsiders her unfortunate decision to back away from her commitment to debate. I also would suggest that Secretary Clinton may want to be not quite so presumptuous about thinking that she is a certain winner. In the last several weeks, the people of Indiana, West Virginia, and Oregon have suggested otherwise. Though Clinton still leads by over 200 delegates and substantially more when pledged superdelegates are included, most of her primary and caucus wins were early in the season and predominantly in the South. States' Democrats have lost to Republicans in recent elections. Sanders has shown momentum, winning 20 states, including most of the recent contests, some by landslides. She is also drawing huge crowds across California compared to Clinton or her husband, former President Bill Clinton. At a rally this week, Sanders said Clinton's refusal to debate is insulting to the people of California, our largest state, then suggested Clinton is not prepared to have a discussion with me about how we address the major crises we face. But with several recent polls showing her comfortably ahead in California, some by double-digit margins, Clinton has little incentive to take stage with Sanders in a debate. Sanders has been known to score come-from-behind victories in several states where he campaigned hard in the final days before the primary election, however, and some 2 million new voters have registered to vote in California, many of them young people, a core Sanders constituency. Besides California, voters on June 7th will also be casting ballots in Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is Meridian Broaddus with a public service announcement from the California Highway Patrol. Memorial Day weekend, one of the busiest travel weekends of the year, is the traditional start of summer in a time when more travelers, and especially families, will be on the go. When California Highway Patrol officers take to the roads over the Memorial Day weekend, they will be working to save lives through seatbelt education and enforcement. To help make motorists safe, the CHP will be conducting its annual Memorial Day maximum enforcement period throughout the state. The special enforcement period begins at 6 p.m. on Friday, May 27th, and continues through midnight on Monday, May 30th. Although the focus is seatbelt usage, the CHP will be watching just as diligently for distracted drivers and those driving under the influence of drugs or alcohol. CHP Commissioner Joe Farrell states, "Everyone inside the vehicle should be safely secured every trip, every time. Seat belts reduce serious crash-related injuries and death. It takes only seconds to buckle up, and those seconds could literally save your life. Furthermore, California law requires that all children under the age of 8 to be properly secured in a child safety seat. 31 people died in collisions during Memorial Day weekend last year. Two-thirds of those killed in the CHP's jurisdiction were not wearing seat belts. More than 1,200 people were arrested for driving under the influence in CHP jurisdiction during the Memorial Day enforcement period. California will also join the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, its nationwide Click It or Ticket campaign, May 23rd to June 5th. Last year, almost 50% of occupants in fatal collisions nationwide were not wearing seat belts. CHP Commissioner Farrell concludes, "So many of the deaths and injuries that occur on the highway are completely preventable. Our job is to make the motoring public aware of the risks and encourage them to be especially cautious this holiday weekend."
Previously, we reported on the uproar that occurred when the San Diego Gay Men's Chorus took the field to perform before a Padres game last week. Their microphones were turned off inexplicably, and a woman's voice singing the Star Spangled Banner blared over the loudspeakers instead. The incident made nationwide news, sparked outrage in the gay community, and prompted Major League Baseball to announce it is investigating the situation. Now the Padres have responded, indicating that although their investigation found no evidence of malicious intent, the mistake and oversight failure prompted the Padres to fire the contractor responsible and discipline an employee. The Padres stated, quote, "We once again sincerely apologize to members of the San Diego Gay Men's Chorus, their families, and those who came out to support their Pride Night performance. The Padres organization is proud of our longstanding commitment to inclusion within both our sport and our community. We deeply regret that a mistake on our part has called this into question, but accept full responsibility, unquote. The San Diego Gay Men's Chorus met with Padres CEO Mike D and issued a statement applauding the Padres' efforts to, quote, bring our communities together with constructive, positive change. In addition, the choral group called on the Padres to give the DJ, known as DJ Artform, his job back, recognizing what they called his support for the LGBT community and equality for all people. The group's statement adds, quote, everyone deserves a second chance. The Padres have not yet indicated whether or not they will reinstate the DJ. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Ed Barrena.
It's all about the buzz. Honeybee populations have plummeted nationwide, leading many communities to take action to protect these important crop pollinators and producers of honey. Now, Lemon Grove is one step closer towards simplifying its beekeeping regulations to make it easier for residents to raise honeybees. Half a dozen members of the San Diego Beekeeping Society gave testimony to the Lemon Grove Council last week to address common fears about beehives. Beekeeper Carlos Richardson told council members and the public, "Good beekeeping keeps our community safe. The revisions would allow permitted hives 25 feet from streets and neighboring homes, far closer than the current 100 feet requirement. The revisions also create a new designation of sensitive site for places such as schools and homes, where a resident has provided documentation to the city of a severe bee allergy. At sensitive sites, the 100 feet limit would be retained." Councilman Jerry Jones voiced concern over allergies. He said his mother-in-law has a severe bee allergy and must use an EpiPen if she gets stung by a bee. The two primary concerns voiced by Beekeeping Society were the permit fee, proposed at $75, and the requirement for permit applicants to notify their neighbors. One resident told council members, "My next-door neighbor has a tree that we're always arguing about, and if I need his permission, I would never receive a permit." Ultimately, the council directed staff to reduce the permit fee from $75 to $35 and eliminate the requirement to notify the neighbors. Instead, Lemon Grove residents with severe bee allergies are asked to notify the city and their homes will be designated as a sensitive site. Eliminating the neighbor notification requirement was important to San Diego Beekeeping Society, since Lemon Grove would have been the first jurisdiction in San Diego County to impose such a requirement. Now here's the buzz. The council extended the public comment period to its June 21st meeting, when council members will vote on their final ordinance. Reporting for the East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Iverson.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. An Uber driver arrested for sexual assault in El Cajon back in March now faces charges as a serial rapist. El Cajon police have charged 52-year-old John David Sanchez with sexually assaulting five additional victims, including raping a 13-year-old child and rape of an unconscious person. Authorities believe those attacks occurred between 2011 and 2014 at Sanchez's home in San Diego. He was released on bail 2 days after his March 29th arrest for sexually assaulting a female passenger while working as an Uber driver in El Cajon. Uber immediately suspended Sanchez. During that investigation, El Cajon police detectives identified the additional victims and, with help from the San Diego District Attorney's Office, obtained a new arrest warrant on March 24th. Sanchez's attorney arranged for Sanchez to surrender to the El Cajon police detectives at the San Diego County Jail, where he was taken into custody on May 24th and booked on multiple felony sexual assault charges. The new victims do not appear to have any connection with Sanchez's former employment as an Uber driver, said Lieutenant Rob Rainswiler with the El Cajon police. Detectives are continuing to search for possible victims or witnesses. Sanchez is Hispanic, 5 feet 7 inches tall, with wavy brown hair and brown eyes. His car, while working for Uber, was a silver 2012 Scion XB. Anyone with information is urged to contact Detective Mansour with the El Cajon Police Department at 619-441-5513. If you have information on these crimes and you wish to remain anonymous, you can contact Crime Stoppers tip line at 888-580-8477. Bail for Sanchez has been set at $1 million.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. Last Thursday, seven Republican representatives in Congress, including San Diego Congressman Daryl Issa, switched their votes at the last minute to kill an amendment in the National Defense Authorization Act that would have prevented government contractors from citing religious liberty as grounds for firing or harassing lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender employees. When the voting clock ran out, the amendment had enough votes to pass, with 217 in support and 206 opposed. But the Republican leadership held the vote open a few more minutes, and several Republican members switched their votes, The Hill reported, leading to the amendment's defeat by a single vote. Eddie Kurtz, executive director of the California-based Courage campaign, blasted Congressman Issa and the others who changed their votes, saying that these legislators, quote, should be deeply ashamed for lacking the courage to stand up to GOP leaders in the House and switching their vote after the clock ran out to deny LGBTQ people critical employment protections. Kurtz called their actions a betrayal of vulnerable constituents, adding that the legislators who switched votes are, quote, more interested in satisfying Republican Party bosses than standing up for the rights that Californians strongly support. Plainly put, these are not California's values, he claimed. Issa and the others who switched their votes have not revealed why they did so. Senator Patrick Maloney, a Democrat from New York and author of the amendment, blamed Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, a California Republican, for orchestrating the effort, pressuring Republicans into changing their votes. Congressman Maloney, who was openly gay, acknowledged that some Republicans did stand their ground against party pressure, and at least a dozen approached him on the floor to express disgust for what happened, The Hill reported. Maloney concludes, I don't think I've ever seen anything that craven and that ugly in my time in Congress. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Ramona Hart Mural Project has already brought seven beautiful murals commemorating Ramona's history to this town, nestled in the mountains of San Diego's East County. Soon, two more murals of epic significance will be on display, thanks to a recent vote by Ramona's Design Review Board approving the projects. The mural of famed aviator Charles Lindbergh, formerly on a building at Lindbergh Field in San Diego, has been donated by the artists John and Jeannie Whalen to the Ramona Hart Mural Project. The artists spent 8 months restoring the landmark mural after San Diego's airport removed it for replacement by a newer, modern mural. The restored mural's new home will be on the outside of the Masonic Lodge in Ramona, chosen because Lindbergh was a Mason, and the lodge's building is large enough to fit most of the mural, though it will still need to be trimmed down at the bottom. Lindbergh was the first aviator to complete a transatlantic flight back in 1927 aboard the Spirit of St. Louis airplane, which was designed and built in San Diego. The Whalens chose Ramona for the Lindbergh mural's new home because the artistic couple had previously painted the first Hart mural, which depicts rodeo star Casey Tibbs. The second new mural approved by Ramona's Design Review Board is titled The Old Swimming Hole, created by artist Tom Guerra in the style of Norman Rockwell. It will depict a boy and his dog jumping into a natural pool at the base of Cedar Creek Falls. Appropriately, this 28-by-17-foot mural will grace the exterior wall of Leslie Pool Supplies on Main Street, the Ramona Sentinel reports. The image captures the nostalgia of a bygone era, since leaping into the pool at Cedar Creek Falls is now banned, following several fatal accidents that occurred at the still-popular swimming destination. Guerra, a lakeside resident and El Cajon native, has done many other prominent murals in East County, including a large mural on the Olaf Weghorst Museum, recreating one of the Western artist's works. His historic murals can be seen along Main Street in El Cajon. Plus, you can find more of this artist's creations along the San Diego Riverwalk and Walker Preserve in Lakeside. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Kirk Kenny, author of a new book called 100 Things Padres Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. My guest is a veteran sports writer who's been writing for the San Diego Union-Tribune since 1985. Welcome, Kirk. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Let's begin with your long career. How did you get started in sports writing?
Well, I was interested, I think, ever since I was a child almost. I had a paper route and enjoyed reading the paper every day, and it kind of got me interested in journalism. Then once I got into college, I worked for the school newspaper at San Diego State. Covered a variety of sports, but I think I gravitated most toward baseball. In fact, that was in 1981, and that team had five players on it that ended up making the major leagues, including one named Tony Gwynn.
Wow. Wow. And so did you ever want to be a baseball player, or were you just always wanted to write about it?
Oh, I think if I had the talent, I would have stayed with it myself, but it takes a pretty good person and player and athlete to achieve at the higher levels, college, and then onto the pros. So I think I chose the right route.
Right. Let's talk about the name of the team. Can you give us a hint of how the Padres came about?
Well, the team's history dates back to the minor leagues in the mid-1930s. It moved down from Los Angeles, and they were searching for a name. And I think with some of the city's history with the missions and such, Padres was a natural name, and it won a contest to have the team named the Padres. And that's where it started. And then when it became a major league team in 1969, they carried the name through.
And what were they called when they were in L.A.?
I believe it was the Los Angeles Stars. But
oh, the Padres is better. Your book, basically, it covers the team's most memorable behind-the-scenes stories over five decades of San Diego baseball history. I know that's a lot, and you're not going to give a spoiler, but what would you consider to be the most memorable memory?
I think the most memorable moment in Padres history is still probably the most memorable moment in San Diego sports history, and that's when Steve Garvey hit a famous home run against the Chicago Cubs that helped propel the Padres to the 1984 National League Championship and the World Series for the first time.
Can you give us any details of that event that make it really stand out?
Yeah, that was the first time the Padres had ever made the playoffs, and they went to Chicago and lost the first two games, so everybody thought, okay, they're pretty much done. But they came back, and they won the first game back in San Diego. It was a best 3 out of 5. And then in the fourth game, in the ninth inning, Garvey came to the plate with one runner on, and he stepped in and hit a home run to right field that just had the crowd go wild, pumped his fist as he went around first base, and was mobbed at the plate. So that tied the series, and the following day, the Padres won, and they were on the way to the World Series. So, it's the delirium of having something happen for the first time.
Yeah, exciting, and don't give up.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you also, in the book, you write about some colorful personalities. Give us a couple of the most colorful personalities I've come across in your career.
Well, I think Tony Gwynn will always stand out the most. He spent 20 years with the team, and he's involved in so many different memorable moments, both of their playoff appearances and World Series appearances that happened in 84, as I mentioned, in 1998. Mm-hmm. Also, he is the last person to come closest to batting 400. He batted 394 in 1994.
And what was colorful about him?
just very quotable, always accessible. Mm-hmm. Had a, he had a laugh that people always mention. It's just one of the greatest laughs you've ever heard. So,
can you imitate it?
I can't even come close, so I'm not going to try.
Okay.
But someone else who I think was very colorful was their owner who saved the Padres from moving to Washington, D.C. in 1974, and that's Ray Kroc. He was the owner of McDonald's. And on the opening night at home, the Padres were having a poor game, and he got on the microphone, I believe, in like the eighth inning, and he apologized to the fans for playing stupid baseball. And as he's doing this, a streaker ran across the field, and he yelled, "Arrest that man." So all this happened on that opening night at home, and that endeared him to the fans, I think, forever.
Oh, wow, that's quite a story.
Yeah, and Ray Kroc was so beloved. I think just he had a passion for the game, mm-hmm. and it really came through to the fans, and they just loved him.
What was the moment in your career so far that you thought, I love doing this, I love covering games, I love writing about this and witnessing this?
I don't know if there's any one moment. I think I was born and raised in San Diego, and I worked at the stadium for about 10 years in high school and college in the vending department, so I was mm-hmm. always around the game a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think just that love of the game, I got to carry that through in a career. And I think, you know, there's just not many more, I think, opportunities to be around the game and do something special like that.
How many people get that opportunity?
Not too many. And in this day and age with contraction in the industry, it's becoming more and more rare. So I feel very fortunate to be able to do it.
You mean the contraction of newspapers?
Newspapers and the industry itself. I think with the internet, we've had a lot of consolidation in various parts of the industry. There just aren't the same amount of opportunities, but certainly with newspapers more so than the others. When I started in this business, there were probably 18 or 20 newspapers in San Diego, and now basically there's one.
That's kind of sad.
Yes, I agree. I see a lot of kids coming out of journalism school now, and they don't have nearly the options that I did. So I don't think that that's a positive thing. And hopefully things will evolve and maybe some mm-hmm. other opportunities will present themselves. Mm-hmm.
Certainly the sports stay popular, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
Yeah. In your book, you talk about some must-do activities that make up the Padre experience. Give us a hint of what some of those activities would be and why you think they're important.
One is trying to collect a set of the Washington Padres cards from 1974. They were so close to moving that Topps baseball cards went ahead and printed them, and it said Washington on the cards instead of San Diego.
Oh, really?
So those are very much a collector's item. Another thing I talk about is trying to get a foul ball at the game. That's always uh-huh. a special souvenir. But I think the biggest thing would be trying to take a trip to Cooperstown. I was back there with my wife, and we were fortunate enough to be there when Tony Gwynn was inducted into the Hall of Fame, and it was a very special weekend. I think close to 85,000 people showed up to watch Tony
wow.
Gwynn and Baltimore's Cal Ripken Jr. going to the Hall of Fame. And there's several Padres artifacts in there that make it worthwhile for a Padres fan, but also just, you know, it's so much baseball history there. It's, mm-hmm. it's a must-do thing for a fan.
Now, do you have any Padres artifacts at home? Do you collect anything?
I have a few different things that I've collected through the years. One of the first I got that's still on my mantle was back in around 1970. I was in the Boy Scouts, and I had the Cub Scouts. And we had a meeting that one of the Padres attended, Mike Ivey, who was a catcher with the team at the time, and they had a raffle, and I ended up winning the autographed Padre baseball, and I still have that.
Awesome. Yeah. One last question. What's next for you? Are you going to write another book? Will it be about the same topic, or is there another sport that you want to focus on?
Right now I'm focused on they're having the All-Star game here in July, and so I've been mm-hmm. doing a lot of All-Star coverage for the newspaper. And there'll be several more stories coming out on that. I do have a few more book ideas. A couple are baseball related. I'd like to pursue if a hitter could ever hit 400 again in the major leagues and maybe tap into that. No one's done it since Ted Williams in 1941, and I think that's a topic that would be interesting to pursue.
Now, what do you hope is the future for the Padres?
Well, I'd like to see them get back to the playoffs. It's been nearly a decade since they were there, and I'm sure everyone would like to see them get back to the World Series and maybe win it this time.
So if you had to give a bit of advice to them, if they were asking you, what would you advise?
I don't know that they'd ask. they need to develop their farm system better and bring up some talented players through that, and then they just need to make a couple good moves on top of that that will help get them back to where they were. It's a recipe for success that I think they followed in both 84 and 98, and I think it would work again.
Well, maybe they should ask you for advice.
Well, I think they have my number, but I won't exactly be waiting by the phone.
Okay, our time is up, Kirk, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
For more information on Kirk Kenny and his book, please visit his Facebook page at facebook.com/Kirk, K-I-R-K, dot Kenny, K-E-N-N-E-Y, dot 5, the number 5. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes a barbecue with firefighters, a Santee craft beer and street festival, the catfish opener at Lake Jennings, and much, much more.
Plus, we'll have previews of coming attractions, including La Mesa's Flag Day Parade, Fido Fest in Santee, the Taste of La Mesa, and Apple Blossom Tea in Julian, and a Western Luau in Descanso. So stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more.
Lake Jennings will hold its catfish opener on Friday, May 27th. The lake will open at 4 p.m. instead of the usual 6 a.m. and will close at midnight. 2,000 pounds of catfish will be stocked for this event. You're invited to come, drop a line, and try to catch a whopper. A full-size lantern is required for each party after 8 p.m. Boats are first come, first serve, and only registered campers will be allowed to fish the campground shoreline during the day on Friday, May 27th, before the catfish opener begins at 4. For more information, you can visit lakejennings.org.
On Saturday, May 28th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., the Heartland Firefighters of Lemon Grove will be hosting their annual barbecue and open house at Fire Station 10 to raise money for the Muscular Dystrophy Association and local charities. This is an opportunity for the community to visit the fire station and see the fire engines up close and talk with firefighters. They will be serving hamburgers and hot dogs along with side dishes.
Croc Kids Junior Theater presents Peter Pan Jr. on May 27th and 28th at 7 p.m. plus a 2 p.m. matinee on May 29th. Based on the Disney film and J.M. Barrie's enchanting play, Peter Pan Jr. is a modern version of the timeless tale about a boy who wouldn't grow up, with no flying required. The score includes new arrangements of classic Disney songs and a story featuring one rousing adventure after another. For tickets and more information, check sdcroccenter.org and click the calendar section.
The Santee Street Fair and Craft Beer Festival draws over 30,000 visitors each year with patriotic fun for the whole family. The 8th annual festival will be held this year on Saturday, May 28th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Riverview Parkway and Town Center Parkway in Santee. This festival will feature local breweries and honor the military on the Heroes Stage. Festival highlights include a craft beer festival, live music and entertainment, a crafter row and artist alley, and over 300 food and vendor booths, carnival rides, and games for the family. For details or tickets, visit SanteeStreetFair.com.
The Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation welcomes acclaimed musician Gregory Page performing his one-man show on Sunday, May 29th. From 3 until 4 p.m. at Mission Trails Regional Park Visitor Center, you're invited to rewind to a bygone era with an afternoon of endearing, enchanting, and entertaining music by the one and only Mr. Gregory Page. Gregory Page is a London-born croonador, that's crooner plus troubadour, and recording artist. The Gregory Page songbook has been featured in film, on television, the BBC, and NPR's Prairie Home Companion. He is an international touring artist and has performed his one-man show in Europe to both critical and popular acclaim. For more information, visit mtrp.org. Now for a preview of coming attractions.
You're invited to a rope and good time at the Cactus Garden Barbecue at the Olaf Weichhorst Museum, a hidden gem in downtown El Cajon, on June 4th and 5th from 5 to 9 p.m. Sons of Charity, Inc. will celebrate famed artist Olaf Weichhorst's iconic art and our region's Western heritage with a cowboy barbecue and a concert by Smith and Western. This event benefits families who are battling childhood cancer in school programs offered by the museum to promote literacy. Also savor the tasty libations, enjoy a live and silent auction, and outdoor concert to boot. For more information, you can visit weichhorstmuseum.org.
The California Old Time Fiddlers Association invites you to the Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest on Saturday and Sunday, June 4th and 5th. Plus, a Saturday night performance by two-time national fiddle champions. There's also a warm-up workshop on Friday, June 3rd, led by the national grand fiddle champions. Whether you're a fiddler, picker, or just a spectator, there's plenty of fun in Julian, with jamming throughout the town during the contest weekend. If you play, you're encouraged to bring yourself and your instrument, and be prepared to smile all day and all night long. For a full schedule and details, you can visit sandiegofiddler.org.
The city of La Mesa shows its patriotic spirit with the La Mesa Flag Day Parade on Saturday, June 4th, 2016. This annual community-supported event is held along La Mesa Boulevard through the downtown village. This year's theme is Salute to Old Glory, and the Grand Marshal will be Cabrillo National Park in honor of the National Park Service's 100th anniversary. Pre-parade concerts start at 9 a.m. featuring local middle school bands. The parade rolls out at 10 a.m. Afterwards, a community ice cream social will be held at La Mesa Boulevard and 4th Street. For more information, you can visit the City of La Mesa's website.
The La Mesa Chamber of Commerce will host its 8th annual Taste of La Mesa on Monday, June 6th from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the La Mesa Community Center. The public is invited to sample fare from many local restaurants and other food providers. Early bird rates are in effect through May 31st. For tickets and reservations, you can visit lamesachamber.com.
In celebration of Hemp History Week, a hemp road trip bus will roll out in East County on Monday, June 6th from 12 noon to 2 p.m. from the parking lot at Mountain Hempire in Alpine. Festivities include a showing of the movie Bringing It Home, a tie-dyed t-shirt making, and food provided by Good Seed Hemp, including burgers, hot dogs, and popcorn. For details, you can visit mounthempfire.com.
The Julian Women's Club will hold its 8th annual Apple Blossom Tea on June 10th at its clubhouse. This event includes a full English tea and foods prepared by the owner of Julian Tea and Cottage Arts, with help from her staff and club members. Gift baskets donated by local merchants will be raffled, and opportunity drawings will provide winners with a wide range of homemade crafts, jellies, and plants in old teacups and teapots. Funds raised help support the club's many philanthropic projects, including high school scholarships, programs for children, and local organizations such as the Historical Society and Friends of the Library. For more information, you can contact Jonna Waite at 760-765-0212.
The City of Santee announces Fido Fest, a Pause in the Park event on June 11th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 550 Park Center Drive, Santee. This event features activities for both pups and people, including a mega adoption event with pups from several rescue organizations, plus an opportunity to benefit dogs on deployment.
The Olaf Weichhorst Museum and Western Heritage Center in El Cajon will host a show of nationally known local artists, including Gloria Chadwick and Grace Schlesser, starting in June. And Art After Five Meet the Artists reception will be held on Thursday, June 16th from 5 until 8 p.m. For details, you can go to weichhorstmuseum.org.
Christian Youth Theater will present the 9th Annual San Diego Follies on June 16th through June 19th at the Helix Main Stage Theater at Helix High School in La Mesa, San Diego's largest musical revue spectacle with dazzling costumes, scenery, and lighting. This year's Time Warp show will feature hilarious skits, musical numbers, flashy dancing, and a live band. For tickets, visit cytsandiego.org.
Lakeside's River Park Conservancy in Lakeside will host its second annual Boars and Brew on Saturday, June 18th from 4 until 7 p.m. You're invited to sip and stroll along the banks of the San Diego River at this event. Guests will receive a complimentary mug for tasting. Discounted rates are available for designated drivers. For tickets and details, visit lakesideriverpark.org.
Howdy and aloha. You're invited to a Western luau blending traditions of Hawaii and the Old West on Saturday, June 11th from 4:30 to 8 p.m. at Chapel of the Hills Community Church in Descanso. This festive event features a pit barbecue, pork dinner, and live music by the Kukui Nuts, plus vendors, gift baskets, and opportunity drawings, including a $1,200 grand prize travel voucher. If you wish to attend, you can call 619-445-3617 to reserve seats. Then you can don your Hawaiian shirts and cowboy boots, grab your partner, and mosey on out to Descanso for this unique multicultural event.
The City of La Mesa's Family Fun Outdoor Concert at Six series will be held once again in Harry Griffith Park, Sunday evenings from 6 to 7 p.m. The series opens June 12th and runs through July 24th. For the season opener, the San Diego Concert Band will perform. Other musical entertainment through the season will include Rhythm and Method, Jazz West, Sonic Epidemic, Silvermine, and the Big Band Ambassadors.
Movies and More by the Lake presents Lights, Camera, Beagle, the Peanuts movie on Friday, June 24th from 6 p.m. to approximately 9:30 p.m. at Santee Lakes. The cast of Young Actors Theater will perform songs from the movie, plus check out Lucy's psychiatric booth and batting practice on an inflatable batting cage.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. My guest today is Carl Calvert from the Board of Directors of the Motor Transport Museum in Campo. Carl is leading the museum's extraordinary effort to restore four of the original buildings at Camp Lockett, a leading California state historic park and a central part of America's military history. Carl Calvert, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Helen.
Now, the Motor Transport Museum is an all-volunteer group, and yet you went out and you purchased four buildings at Camp Lockett. And why did you do that? What is the significance?
We needed more space to store our vehicles in that was covered and enclosed. Most of our vehicles are kept outside. We're open to the public, and they come in and wander around and look at our vehicles outside. But in our efforts to continue to preserve these vehicles, we can preserve them much better if they're inside. And by purchasing these buildings and putting them in use again, then we can put some of the vehicles inside the building.
So in other words, you're going to become a permanent caretaker.
Yes.
Of a very important site. The county must be delighted.
Yes, the county previously owned the buildings, and they were not using them. They were declining in condition. They were boarded up. They even appeared to be blighted because they were not in use. And our interest in these buildings wasn't just to keep vehicles and collections inside of them, but it was also to be able to see them reused again and restore them and rehabilitate the buildings. So,
what was the original use of the four buildings that you purchased?
The Army built them in 1941. There was originally 25 of these buildings in Campo that housed the horses for the cavalry. The Army had a number of cavalry posts across the United States but they wanted one in the western part of the country here. So they built this camp called Camp Lockett in 1941 to house the soldiers that later became known as the Buffalo Soldiers. And
the famous African-American Buffalo Soldiers.
Yes. Okay. And it turned out to be the last cavalry camp that the government had. Other ones were disbanded in earlier years, but this managed to survive. After the use as a cavalry, the county bought the camp. They were originally used as horse stable buildings for Camp Lockett. There was 25 of them originally, and only four remain. But they kept the horses in these buildings. There was up to 58 horses kept in each one of the buildings. There was about 3,000 horses at this camp at one time.
My goodness.
Quite a few horses out there. The cavalry that was at Camp Lockett, they housed the African-American soldiers there, and they later became known as the Buffalo Soldiers, very famous soldiers.
Yes.
And they trained them on how to use horses, and there was large fields there in the area where every day they would take the horses out and train the troops on how to care for the horses and train them on how to use them.
Carl, I've seen these buildings. There's a forest of lumber in there. Back in the day when they used whole tree trunks to make beams and ceilings.
Yes, yes.
They're quite extraordinary looking. Do you hold a giant fundraiser? Are you getting any help for this big project?
Yes, we are getting some help for it. The county has been extremely helpful. We've applied, for example, this last year, we applied for three different grants. We were able to get approval on two of them. And we're slowly working on the buildings. The first thing we needed to do was replace the roofs to help preserve these buildings so they wouldn't leak. And we finished the first building, and we're now working on the second building with a brand new roof. And it's mostly volunteer labor that's working with me to rehab these buildings.
My goodness. Yeah. So you have a lot of skilled people contract skills.
Yes, our membership is quite varied. People from all different trades. That we have electricians, contractors, and people that are members of the museum.
Is the U.S. government aware of what you're doing?
I don't know that the U.S. government is. We applied for a U.S. government grant, and we were not successful in obtaining that. We've been more successful in getting grants on a local level.
Well, that's very heartening news. Do you have plans to open the four former stable buildings?
Yes,
on
we
a
do
date
eventually.
Certain?
Yes.
Okay.
Once we get the roofs on them, we will address other issues like the electric windows. A lot of the windows were broken. They were vandalized at one point, and people broke the glass out of the windows, and we'll replace the doors. But essentially, we're trying to rehabilitate these buildings so they look from the outside as they did originally, as much as possible. The inside has been changed a little bit because after the Army used the buildings, the county bought them, and they leased them to the Mountain Empire School District, and they put junior high and high school facilities inside the buildings, and that's where many of the local people went to school there years ago.
Then you must be making a lot of people in Campo very happy.
Oh, we are. Right. We get a lot of accolades, yes.
Carl, this is an extraordinary story, and I want to thank you for stopping by, and I hope you'll come again because we want to learn more about the Motor Transport Museum.
Good. It's
thank
my pleasure,
you.
Helen.
And thank you for listening to The Sounds of History. I'm Helen O'Field.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5.
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.